This is Taste for Tenacity, show number 21.
Lady, where your pants gone? Yeah. I'ma make you dance to my dance song. Oh, lady.
What's going on, everybody? My name is Ben Trella, and this is Taste for Tenacity. This week on the show, I am joined by Christy Shen and Bryce Leung. They are bloggers, the founders of Millennial Revolution, and the authors of Quit Like a Millionaire. Christy and Bryce, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
Cool. Very excited to talk a bit more about personal finance and financial independence in particular. And you had a couple of really cool stories that I wanted to make sure to share. So let's kind of dive right into it. What was your story sort of like? Did you go the college route? And what really sort of led you toward the direction you chose?
For sure. Okay. So when we started, we were living in Toronto in a very expensive housing market. And I was kind of following the status quo, you know, the thing that our boomer parents, like everybody says, you have to get your degree and then you got to buy the house and then you work until you're 65, you get a good job and then maybe retire with a pension. That's kind of the good life that everybody subscribes to.
Definitely.
So that's what we were doing, except we were trying to buy a house and then houses were over $1 million for the single family home.
Oh, that's ideal. Right?
So,
great.
Yeah. So I was like, you know what? This doesn't really make any sense. And on top of that, that whole idea that we can just have one job and work until you're 65 and retire. I don't know about you, but I don't know a lot of people that can just work one job and then get a pension at 65.
Yeah.
And what was happening with where I was working, so I was working as a computer engineer, was that there were people getting laid off from the company and they were doing a lot of outsourcing. So job security was definitely something that I was struggling with. And I think that's something that our generation as millennials definitely struggled with a lot more than the previous generation. So, you know, with those two things that we've been told, you got to buy the house and you got to work until you're 65, not quite working out the way that we've been told. At that point, we started to think, so, you know, this is about 6 years into our working careers, we started thinking about, do we really want to follow this path? Like, maybe this is a path that worked for our parents, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but it just clearly doesn't work anymore. So that's when we started looking into investing in the stock market, doing index investing. We started discovering blogs like Mr. Money Mustache and J.L. Collins, which talks about something called financial independence. It's the idea that if you build a portfolio big enough, you can safely withdraw 4% from that portfolio and it will last you for the rest of your life. So at that point, which means your money will come from the portfolio to cover your expenses and you don't have to work again. So the first time I discovered this financial independence, I thought it was witchcraft. And I was very suspicious.
Yeah. She was so skeptical of this entire thing.
Yeah.
I was like, Ponzi scheme.
Exactly. So, I mean, having grown up in China, because I wasn't actually born in the West, I had grown up in China until I was 8 and then immigrated to Canada. My first instinct was thinking, like, there's no way this is possible. I mean, what you're supposed to do is put your money in a house, which is really safe, or you put it into a savings account. And then it wasn't until I started learning about investing that, oh, putting money into a savings account is actually not very safe because your money is being eroded by inflation. So then the more I learned about investing and the more I learned about financial independence and having all sorts of job insecurity at work and then my work is getting really stressful, that when Bryce first showed me the math that says we could actually retire if we go down this financial independence path in the next 3 to 5 years, I started to kind of come more like down that path and thinking maybe this is possible. And then as we saved more money towards financial independence, because I actually had a goal, we actually did end up retiring just 3 years after we discovered financial independence in 2015. And we have been traveling the world for the last 4 years.
Which I imagine is not a bad life at all.
Definitely.
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
After this, we're like going to be flying to Portugal and then after that, Dublin. And after that, like who knows where, because our life is completely nomadic now, because after we decided to just ditch the whole like working thing, we decided to do like a trip around the world just like as a victory lap.
Yeah.
And what we've discovered is that if you travel like a local, in other words, not staying in hotels, staying in Airbnbs instead, or renting local like housing stock and this kind of stuff, and cooking and it's just like living normally.
Yeah.
The cost of traveling the world can be less expensive than the cost of staying in one place in an expensive city like Toronto or New York or LA. So when we realized that, we were like, hey, we could do this forever. And then we just been doing it.
And then
forever.
We just did.
We just been doing
it. Yeah. So you come out of college and you get into computer programming. What was that shift like for you? How did things go, going from, you know, very almost education focused life into now being a part of the workforce? What was that shift like?
Oh, okay. So my pick for computer engineering was actually a strategic pick. So originally I actually wanted to be an author. But, you know, having grown up poor in China, I couldn't actually just take the risk that it was going to work out because I'll just move back in with my parents. No, I would probably drag them down financially because at that point they were still sending money back home to support my family. So I had to be really careful about picking a career at that point. And so picking computer engineering was actually going against, you know, that advice from Steve Jobs, which is like, you will follow your passion and then, you know, it'll all work out and the money will come. Well, you know, it really depends on what your passion is, because for him, he was already interested in computers. Yeah, that's a lucrative passion. For me, it's like being an author. And then as I later found out, working as a computer engineer and then writing on the side, I found out that authors make on average $5,000 a year.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is pretty close to like how much I was making on the side. So I thought, you know, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this full time. So I was actually quite grateful that I actually picked computer engineering, which is why in the book, there's a chapter we talk about. I used a metric I created called the pay over tuition score, or the POT score, which allows you to figure out what is the return on your investment. Because if you get into a lot of debt to get a degree that doesn't give you a job, is that money well spent? Do you really want to be locked in, you know, debt for many, many years and never being able to get ahead financially? So I do not regret that decision to not follow my passion.
Okay.
And then, but you know, the idea that we could just have one job with that passion, like doing that even strategically, doesn't make sense. So I think a combination of picking that strategic career, which was a good return on investment, plus using that to become financially independent because you are being paid quite well as a lucrative career, allowed me to actually follow my passion afterwards, because I did actually become an author. So after we retired, an editor from Penguin contacted us to write a book, and that's Quit Like a Millionaire. So as a result, you know, it's kind of like, don't follow your passion and then buy it back later, which is what we were able to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a good shift, because there's sort of two ways to do it. You know, like you said, you get a strategic, straightforward job that you can use to essentially build out your portfolio and then live off of that. So you're delaying pursuing your passion, but it's still within your realm and it's still within the plan.
For sure. Yeah.
But and the thing is, it can happen in parallel. Mm-hmm. Like while we were working, both working as computer engineers, she was writing on the side, and I joined in, and I realized that I actually kind of enjoyed this as well. So we were actually writing. So we were working for a total of about 9 years, but we were writing and learning how to become a writer for the last 5 of those 9 years. So nearly half of our career, we were actually working 2 jobs. We would go to work, and then we would, you know, do our normal day job and you know, do as well as we could at that, and come home, and every evening and weekend we would write like a maniac, and we would and the thing is, the thing that people don't get about following their passion is it takes time to build up the skills in order to actually make it commercially in that field. I mean, like when we were in university, it took us 4 years to just in school to learn enough to be employable in that field. But it was about the same amount of time for writing. We went through like 3 manuscripts of like fiction books that we just wrote, and then just threw away because they weren't good enough.
Yeah, 75 rejections. That's not fun.
Yeah. We were trying to get published at the time, and that was probably the hardest thing we've ever had to do, and that includes all of engineering and all that kind of stuff. Because when you get like a rejection from an agent or from the publishing industry, they don't tell you what's wrong with it, and you have to actually write the entire manuscript before you pitch it. So
okay.
So it's actually a very, very long, arduous, frustrating loop of rejection, and then guessing and what went wrong, and then doing it again, and then rejection. And so, yeah, it was probably one of the least fun.
It was very painful, but it's worth it. But somebody has to pay the bills while you're developing, you know, those skills to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. So really your approach was more focused on having that safe, stable income, because you did have such a tumultuous experience growing up, and you had a lot of challenges and uncertainties throughout your development.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why I became financially independent, because people say, oh, is it because you hated your job? Like, what if you had just liked your job? I'm like, well, it's because I grew up poor and I never, ever wanted to be poor again. I don't want that financial security. And there's actually, financial insecurity. I wanted financial security for the rest of my life. And that's one of the reasons I became financially independent.
So you used it essentially to leverage and say, hey, I'm going to build that skill set while working in a regular job. Mm-hmm. Pay the bills, but you're also already pursuing your passion in a way to where once you're done and once you reach that FI number, then you can double down on what you actually enjoy doing and where you want to go instead of the standard path.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's why we call it the most reproducible path, because if someone like me who grew up in rural China and at one point had to live on 44 cents a day could get to becoming a millionaire by following this mathematically proven path, then like a lot of people will be able to reproduce it, versus other paths, you might be shooting for the moon, but that requires a lot of luck and timing. Whereas this one, it really is kind of a strategic skill that you develop, and then you use that to actually follow this path and get to becoming financially independent.
Right, because the nasty thing about passion kind of projects, not all of them. If your passion is going to be an investment banker, you're good. Like that, you're in a good spot. But a lot of like arts and a lot of like even entrepreneurial stuff, the income doesn't come right away, and the income is also uneven. So that's something that is even now that our blog is making money. If you average it at the end of the year, you add it all up and you just kind of like, okay, that's great. But the thing is, some months it will be $2,000 or $3,000 at once.
Very volatile.
Very volatile.
It's extremely volatile. And I realized that
difficult to live off of.
If I was doing that full time as a way to like pay my rent, I would be stressed out.
Yeah.
But because our portfolio is creating this passive and steady income stream that just comes out of it every year. It actually solves financial independence actually solves one of the biggest problems of entrepreneurship, which is how do you live off of an unsteady, volatile income? And the answer is you don't. You create a steady, it's almost like building your own pension. You create steady income yourself, and then that gives you the freedom and the freedom and the safety net to allow you to really go for the moonshots and this kind of stuff. We would never have done any of this book stuff we would never have lasted long enough in this writing field if we had to depend on it for food, because we would have run out of money. We would have had to quit. That's just the thing of it. So the nice thing about this is really this approach that we talk about in the book really gives you the best of both worlds. It gives you a steady paycheck and the ability to follow your dreams, but at a certain point.
Yeah. Okay. So you stumble across financial independence and personal finance through a number of different blogs. What are some of the first lessons that you came across, and what have been some of the major impacts of those over the last few years?
I think the biggest impact for me was reading Mr. Money Mustache's post on how in order to build the portfolio, it's actually more about your savings rate and not about how much you earn. Because a lot of the times, we've been taught like just earn the big salary and like be a doctor and be a lawyer and all that, right? Mm-hmm. But their expenses are actually really high, right? So it really is, you have to subtract the difference. And when you actually look at the math behind financial independence, you'll find out that it's like, if you actually save more, then you actually need less to live on, right? So the goalpost is actually getting closer. So you get like a double win by increasing your savings rate, you're reducing the portfolio you need to retire, and you're also saving a lot more money towards the portfolio. So that was mind-blowing to me. It's like, oh, wow, it's based on savings rate. It's not just like everybody who earns six figures doesn't actually mean they're going to become FI faster. It really is the difference, the gap between your earnings and your expenses.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's focusing on what you can actually control. The income side, like you said, especially in sort of the entrepreneurial or art-centered worlds, can be very volatile. But by forcing your savings rate down, not only are you increasing the amount you're stashing for later, but you're also lowering the amount you need to live on. So even that volatile income ultimately starts to kind of stabilize itself through reducing your spending.
Absolutely. Right. And to your point, there's like, if you actually work on something that you're passionate about, you can actually become partially FI, right? Because if you're not planning to just sit on a beach and do nothing, which is, what happens with a lot of young people, we don't actually just sit on a beach and do nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe even if you don't become fully financially independent, but your portfolio pays for like 50% of your expenses, maybe you can go from a really stressful job to like something that you're really passionate about. It gives you a lot more free time, but you would never have considered that job because you're like, oh, this job only pays $20,000. Obviously, I can't live off of that. But if your portfolio is paying like $30,000, you're like, all of a sudden, I can take this passionate job instead of constantly trying to go for a really high paycheck.
Yeah, so you stretch the impact that your money has by lowering the amount you even need to live off of.
Yes.
And so another interesting thing that you've hinted at throughout is your definition of retirement. Is it sitting back, laying on a beach, and playing golf every day of the week, as a lot of times comes to mind when we hear the word retirement? How does retirement look for you?
Yeah, so that's one of the misnomers of the acronym FIRE. So within the FIRE community, so FIRE stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. So whenever people hear about the FIRE community, a lot of people, like the biggest criticism is like, retirement? I don't want to retire. And the thing that we tell people is the FI part is mandatory because that helps you be financially stable, but the RE part, the retirement part, is absolutely optional. So a lot of the times, like people, you know, you want to sit on a beach and then you try to do that because you're decompressing from your job. But 6 months later, inevitably, you want to do something, right? Mm-hmm. Like whether it's volunteering, whether it's starting another passion, something. So I really think that retirement is really evolving. And because jobs are now moving, a lot of jobs can be done online. A lot of like passion projects can be started online. People are taking advantage of geographic arbitrage to like increase that gap between how much they earn and how much they spend, and also allow them to work a job that allows them to be anywhere, right? So that's like a perfectly valid, you know, passion project to do in retirement if you want to do something online, something that's, you know, something that you've already wanted to start a online business. Now you can do it with a lot less risk and you can do it from anywhere in the world. So I think it opens up that a lot of possibilities. So when we say retirement, we mostly mean retirement from the 9 to 5, like that rigid idea that you have to go into an office, you have to sit there from 9 to 5 because that's what the company says and you're relying on them for a paycheck. Now you get to decide what your retirement looks like. And if you want to sit on a beach and do nothing, perfectly valid.
You can.
If you want to work on some passion project online, totally fine. It's totally up to you. It's all about choices.
We actually, for ours, it actually, we did the 1 year traveling around the world, and we maybe kind of did that, like literally just did nothing except travel for about 6 months or so. And then, and then gradually we kind of went, all right, well, let's see what we can do and let's see what else we want to do. Cause again, we wanted to not just retire from work in general, but we wanted to really pursue Christy's passion, which was writing. And we ended up doing that together. So we did end up getting published, you know, a book called Little Miss Evil, which is a fiction book for kids. That was the first book that we got published. And after that, we started the blog and we started writing about our financial independence journey there. And then the opportunity came to do a book with Penguin about that. And that became Quit Like a Millionaire. And it's just like, there's so many opportunities that ended up like coming to us that we really, you know, we keep joking with each other. It's like, we're not really retired. We're just tired at this point. Because there's just so many, because we're working probably the same amount of hours that we were working and sometimes even more.
But it's like fun.
But it's stuff
and you can
actually
choose. Yeah.
You get to choose the project that you work on. You get to choose the core that you want to work with and you want to choose, and you get to choose the hours that you work during the day. Like we don't literally sit in a desk from 9 to 5 anymore. We'll like, you know, we just came from like chilling out at the beach just now, and then after this we might go and like go, you know, bike around the neighborhood or something like that.
Yeah,
like we use our working hours really in ways that make sense for us. But the actuality of it is that it didn't actually reduce the amount of work that we're doing. It we're just doing it in, we're just redirecting it in a way that we actually enjoy and it helps people, to be honest.
Actually, but speaking to the helping people thing, I think financial independence makes you more authentic, because one of the things it does is allow you to pick projects that are aligned with your values, right? Because when you work for a company and you need the paycheck, if the company's values start drifting away from you, then you don't really have a choice because you need the money. But when you don't need the money, when we get all these opportunities, because we're no longer in the same location, like geographically, we can be anywhere in the world, and then with that comes a lot of opportunities. We can say no to opportunities that just doesn't align with our mission. For example, because of the blog, we've been getting requests from financial companies or just tech startups saying, we want to make a FIRE fund because we want to help people become financially independent. And you're like, really? So I'm always a skeptic. So my first thought is like, really? Are you really helping people, or are you jumping on a bandwagon? Mm-hmm. So then I look at, you know, what's within their fund, like what kind of stocks they have as part of their fund. And then I look at it, I'm like, this is not helping people. You're adding a lot of fees, and it really is making you rich and not your clients rich. So we immediately say no to that opportunity. And even if it's a lot of money, it doesn't matter because I don't need the money anymore. right? Yeah. So it makes you, allows you to make decisions that actually help people and are aligned with who you are, rather than you have to make a decision just because you need to pay the bills.
Yeah, retirement isn't anymore, you know, retiring from work entirely. It's retiring from the work you don't want to do. Exactly. And as you said, pursue directly the ways you want to go. Now, real quick, there was one term you mentioned that I wanted to circle back to, geographic arbitrage. For anyone who's unfamiliar with the subject, could you define that for us?
Sure. I think this is a term that came out of Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week. So it's the idea that you work somewhere that you earn, where you earn a high, strong currency. So for example, like American dollars or like British pounds, mm-hmm. and then you live somewhere with a weak currency. So maybe you live in Thailand, maybe you live in Poland, and you have the zloty, right? So then that allows you to have a big gap between how much you earn and how much you spend. And then it allows you to live like a life of freedom a lot faster. And geographic arbitrage, you don't even have to do it within different countries. You can even do it within the same country, but in different locations. So for example, if somebody was working online and earning money in New York and have a very high salary, but then they're living in like Detroit, or maybe they're living in like Raleigh or somewhere like mm-hmm. that, and then all of a sudden their expenses are half as much, and then all of a sudden you're becoming financially independent so much faster, and you're raising your savings rate because you need less money to get to retirement, and you get to save a lot more. Every single dollar you get, you receive, you get to put that towards your portfolio.
Yeah. So Tim Ferriss's kind of introduction to this was in the context of like literally physically separating yourself from your job, so that your job is like still, and he was like saying like hire VAs like to do this for you, or something mm-hmm. like that, and then live in another way. We adapted it for financial independence because now it's not just the work itself, it's that your savings and your portfolio is in one location and it's paying you American dollars or Canadian dollars, but then you're living in a really cheap place. So we kind of adapted the idea of geographic arbitrage to FIRE. So yeah. That's kind of what we discovered, which is if you can, by simply choosing where you spend your time, you can lower your budget and you can drastically lower how much money that you need to spend in retirement while increasing your quality of life. Because like all of a sudden, like, because when we go to Thailand or we go to a place like, you know, Portugal or Poland, in Thailand, our budget, like our budget when we're living in North America is about $40,000.
Okay.
When we're in Thailand, we can drop that to about $20,000 to $25,000 a year, and yet we're sitting on a beach and we're not like being buried in snow. So
yeah.
Like that's a good example of that's a concrete example of how geographic arbitrage can make your retirement much, much safer, because you can control how much money you're spending each year simply by choosing what percentage of the year you're spending in different locations.
Gotcha. So geographic arbitrage is really leveraging your living situation to help your money go a little bit further. So earning in a high income zone, we'll call it, and then living in an area where your cost of living and all of your expenses are a lot lower.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
Awesome. And so you started down this path to financial independence. Could you walk us through sort of what it was like to slowly see that number grow and grow, and what it's like to be walking toward essentially your dream?
Oh, yeah. So initially, I was really, really stressed at work, and a lot of people around me were on medication. That's kind of the thing we do now in society. When you got a problem, you medicate that problem. You got anxiety, you got depression, you got stress. Just take more medication, right? But in reality, it's the lifestyle that needs to change, because the medication just becomes addictive and it doesn't really help you. So the more our portfolio grew over time and the more money I had, the less stress I became over time, right? So at the end, I saw a lot of coworkers struggling and I felt really bad for them, because a lot of them were trapped in really, really expensive mortgages and they didn't really have a choice, because it was, if they were got put on a really bad project, they just had to do it, right?
Yeah.
And I think I was actually able to become more insolent over time, because I was just like, what? I'm not going to work on this project. And then my coworkers are like, oh my God, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to get fired. And I didn't get fired.
Yeah.
Right. So it really is, it gives you more power to push back when things are being unreasonable. And you don't even have to be financially independent in order to do that. Just having more money and being more financially secure allows you to really kind of protect yourself against being taken advantage of. And, you know, when companies inevitably do outsourcing and things like that, that's completely outside your control, it'll help you sleep at night.
Yeah. But and what it felt like to watch that number grow. I mean, like when we for the majority of our working career, we were trying to save up a down payment to buy a house. And in Toronto and in a high cost city like Toronto and New York, you get this annoying problem where you save money, but then the houses just keep getting more expensive. So you never really quite feel like you're getting progress.
Yeah.
And it was at a certain point when we hit $500,000, and we were like in our savings, just in our cash like savings account, and then that kind of went, okay, this is kind of a lot of money.
Yeah,
like,
I don't want to just give it.
Do we want to just hand this over to a real estate agent?
Yeah,
because I would then exchange $500,000 for $750,000 of debt that I then have to pay off. I
mean, yeah.
But $500,000, when we started to invest it, and it started to grow as we kept adding onto the pile, like $500,000 was kind of like our low number. Then when it became like six, it was just kind of like Jesus. And then when it was like then seven and eight, it was like, holy crap, this is actually working. And then 900,000 was this agonizing like journey to like, come on, just cross over that 1 million. Just
yeah.
We'd go up and down. We would go back. We would put in like $10,000 and then the stock market would go down like 7,000. We'd be like, no.
Jump up like but a then huge
when,
amount. Yeah.
But then when it actually like crested over, yeah, and we saw that that number rolled to 1 million, we were just kind of like,
wow. Yeah. It blew my mind because as a child, I wouldn't even have understood the concept of $1 million. I would have been like, that's like infinite amount of money.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I think it's, people think it's really difficult in the beginning, like getting the first six figures really, really hard. But as you put in those systems to put in money periodically away, and you know that you're working towards your goal, it's like a snowball effect. It gets faster and faster, and it's a compounding effect because the money makes more money, which makes more money, which makes more money. Then it's like your money is like a whole bunch of little soldiers going out and then just working for you, and you don't have to do anything, and they just multiply on their own, right? So that concept, it's like seeing compounding in real life, and then as the compounding goes up, your stress goes down. And then over time, when you reach that number, you're like, I'm done. I'm free. I can do whatever I want. It's the most incredible feeling ever. Seriously. There's like very few things in life that I've experienced that matches up to the happiness that financial independence gives you. It's not just, once you become financially independent, then like you never have to worry about anything again. Like you still have to figure out your identity, which is something that people worry about in retirement and things like that. But just having that choice and being authentic and being able to make choices that are aligned with your values, I think it's the best thing that money could ever buy. It's freedom. It's the best thing money could ever buy.
That being said, we had a really, really happy, joyous occasion, like feeling when we got there. Mm-hmm. There is actually some people that actually get the financial benefit and it scares them. So there's this effect that I think Money Must actually coined it called the wall of fear. That some people, because we do a lot of conferences and we do a lot of like one-on-one counseling at these conferences about like what people are like helping people get to their FI number, and some of them are really, really close and they come up to us and we just kind of like, I'm terrified of becoming FI, and we're like, what, why? Because their identity is wrapped up in their work. So when you quit, like if you've been like a lawyer or an accountant or a doctor for like 20 years and that's all you've ever been, mm-hmm, and you like give that up to become, then it's kind of like, well, then what am I? So there's an existential crisis that can happen if you don't build up the second identity, which is why I think it was still a little scary for you. I think.
Oh yeah, it was terrifying
when you actually give your notice. But the reason why it was that the transition was relatively smooth for us was because we had spent the past 5 years leading up to our FI journey, like building that second identity, right? Mm-hmm. And we were able to step into the identity of an author or a writer pretty seamlessly. And if people don't think about that, and they just laser focus on getting to their FI number and then forget about anything else, yeah, that can seem a little bit scary. So there's a bit of a caution that you have to think about what makes you passionate. Yeah. Because we spend most of our lives, mm-hmm, making our decisions based on money. Yeah. Like, what do we do? Like, does this pay more? Does that pay more? And like this. Mm-hmm. When that incentive system goes away, it can be scary because now people don't know how to make decisions because they can't just use money as a way to.
You can't hide behind it anymore.
You can't hide behind money anymore. You have to say, what is it that you want to do? What kind of life do you want to lead? What kind of work do you want to do to help the world? And for a lot of people, they haven't thought about that. They kind of go, I don't know.
Because you don't have time to think about it normally when you're working, right? You're just trying to pay the bills. There's no time to really think about the big question. And that's quite scary. But then we all need to think about it, because on your deathbed, do you want to be looking back and thinking, oh, I wish I had done this. I could have done this. I could have done that, instead of actually taking the time and thinking about it. Like, is this what I want to do? So I know that on my deathbed, I'm going to have no regrets. Like, I'm already living the life that I want to live and not something that's dictated. So that question is very, very difficult to answer, and it's scary, but we all need to answer it.
Yeah. And it seems like the most important thing is to not be pursuing that dollar number or that pursuing financial independence solely for financial independence's sake. It's what do you actually want that to buy you? What do you want your life to look like? And if you don't have that from the beginning, it's going to be a lot more terrifying as you reach that number.
Right. Yeah. Which is what I think your podcast does really well, which is you're trying to get people to think about, like, how do you live a life in which you're pursuing your passion, and thinking about, because in order to do that, you have to answer the question, what is your passion?
Yeah.
And that could change too.
And the thing that could change.
And it's not just like one singular passion, right? Like some people have many, many different passions, and then it might change as you go through your life. You might have like 10 different passions and you pursue all of them throughout your life. You know, it's not just one singular thing.
Yeah. Cause most of us answer the question of what do you want to do with your life? The answer is like make a lot of money. And it's like, okay. But you know, there is a point in which that, you know, there has to be a purpose beyond just make, what do you want to do with this money?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a tool, right? It's a tool. It's not just used for your status symbol to impress other people how much money you make, because that just rings hollow after a while. It really is a tool to get you to the freedom and to get you to a life that you think is the life that you choose.
Yeah. And that extra layer of probing, it does tend to get very uncomfortable and it's terrifying. It's like, oh, why do I want this? Is it because I think it's going to be stable, or is it because I want to do this instead?
Right.
Yeah. People aren't used to asking these kinds of like deep philosophical questions because it's introspective. And sometimes, it's, you know, people don't like being introspective. They don't like to just sit there and kind of think, who am I as a person? Mm-hmm. And what is it that I believe? Those are very difficult questions to answer because, you know, it's easy to just kind of go, money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what have been some of the unanticipated benefits of pursuing financial independence? Was there anything you weren't really expecting that wound up paying off really well?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of other people that we met that we never expected to meet. So one of the things that happens when you go to a 9-to-5 job is you end up in this bubble of people who think the same way as you. They kind of live the same lives because you're physically locked to that location to go to that job.
Yeah.
But once we started traveling, we met all sorts of people from many different walks of life. One community that we met is, so there's this woman that we met in Tulum, Mexico, and she was traveling with her 10-year-old son. And this was in, I think it was March or April, March, right? And I asked her, I was like, oh, you took him out for the last couple of months out of school? Like, is that okay? I thought, because it's the school year, it's not the summer. How are you doing that? And she said, oh, we're part of something called World Schoolers. And I was like, what? This is mind blowing. Tell me more about this. And so I literally wouldn't let her go anywhere for the next 2 hours. And I just peppered her with so many questions. Like, tell me about this. How does this work? Is this our community? Like, how does this? And then she kind of broke it down with, so there's this new school of thought where you instead of just going to, like, again, the status quo, they're very out of the box thinking, very similar to the FIRE kids, in that they teach their kids world as their classroom. So instead of learning about Vietnam, for example, in the Vietnamese War, you actually go to Vietnam and you actually talk to veterans that have been in the war, and then you find out that it's called they call it the American War and not
really?
The Vietnam War. And like things like that you never would have known from a textbook. And then they figure out math by currency conversions. And many of them speak multiple languages because, you know, they've lived in Mexico, they speak Spanish. Some of them lived in China, they speak Mandarin. Some of them have lived in like Germany, they speak German. And so, and then it's like a mixture of different types of curriculums. Because I said, well, if you're not a teacher, how are you supposed to teach your kids this?
Yeah.
And said, oh, they have packages online where they have a curriculum that they can buy. And then there's teachers that teach them like with Skype. There's also international schools that they put their kids into to like get to know the local culture and the children and things like that. There's correspondence schools. There's unschooling, in which it's kind of like Montessori, where the kid drives what they want to learn, and then the parents facilitate by finding people within that, experts within that field to teach their kids. So it's like, I would have never met people like this in my career. In fact, in the bubble that I was in, people would have thought this was crazy. They would have been like, no way, that's not going to work. That's crazy. Nobody would ever do that. And just, you know, the different people from different walks of life and entrepreneurs, we got offered three we had 3 job offers in Thailand just getting a haircut. Because there's so many like expats and digital nomads in Chiang Mai, right? And they're like, oh, we're working on like this, developing this SEO algorithm. Like, do you want to be coding for us and things like that?
Yeah, that's another, there's another community that we discovered afterwards, which is, they're called the digital nomads.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is this whole group of basically kind of like, they're not all IT or tech workers, but a lot of them are, but some of them are also writers. Some of them can be,
marketing,
can be consultants, yeah. Marketing, whatever. But basically they work, they're not FI, but they work using their laptop. So all they need to do is have a laptop and an internet connection and they're good. So they go off and travel. And again, they live in low cost cities that have really good infrastructure for entrepreneurship. She mentioned Chiang Mai. That's a big one in Thailand. There's another one.
Lisbon.
Lisbon is another hub of this stuff in Portugal. Estonia, Tallinn is actually a big hub of these ones.
Because that's Estonia, cool.
Never would have thought to go to Estonia, until after we retired.
Estonia is where Skype is from. And Estonia is, as a country, kind of getting tired of being bullied around by like Russia. And they're trying to build Estonia up as the Silicon Valley of Europe kind of thing.
That's cool.
So they have all these like all this infrastructure and encouraging people to come and work in Estonia. And the nice thing about living in a low cost city like this is that when you're like what we were saying, the when you're just starting off, it takes a while for your income to come in.
Yeah.
If you're able to take your team and then move it to a low cost city like this, all of a sudden your expenses drop and your runway for getting that first sale is a lot longer. Right? Hmm. So we discovered these like kind of hubs of entrepreneurship all over the world that have kind of taken this idea of geographic arbitrage and really ran with it.
Yeah.
So it's really just meeting dip people and just finding these communities of people living such non-standard and cool lives.
Yeah.
It just, that was really the surprising and a surprising benefit of this entire journey.
Yeah. What are some of the, and for anyone listening that's now like, okay, this financial independence thing, that's kind of cool. What are some of the common objections that you guys have heard? Like, oh, I love my job now. Why would I want to quit? And how would you respond to them?
Yeah, that's definitely one of them. I love my job. Why would I want to quit? And our response is, you don't have to, right? The whole point is to be financially set so that in case anything happens to your job, right? Because sometimes that happens. You get laid off, or your manager changes, or your team changes, and it totally becomes a different job. I've had that happen to me. And now you're financially independent, so you don't have to worry. You're stress-free. So if you like your job, continue working at your job. One of the things that people ask is, are you worried about losing your community, right? And that's part of it because you're traveling. Or people who are, you know, their coworkers are now working and they're staying at home and they don't have to work anymore. They're losing a big part of that community. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You build a new community. There's like a lot of FI events all around the States and in Europe. One of them is like the Choose FI groups. There's a lot of people who meet up locally. We just went to one in Toronto.
Oh, nice.
We're part of a financial retreat called Chautauqua. So that happens in 4 weeks a year, and it happens in different places in Europe where you meet like-minded people, and then those are kind of your friends for life, because we've been traveling around the world and we meet people from the retreat that we've known, and it's kind of like our global family that we just go around and meet people. Mm-hmm. That's part of this community. So it's like a whole, you know, in addition to the one you had before. So it's really not that scary to lose that connection, because you end up gaining so many other connections as a result of it. I think we have maybe triple or quadruple the number of friends we used to because of, you know, these additional communities, and not just from the FIRE community, but also from digital nomads, right? And like people from different backgrounds that we never would have come across because we're physically not located in a place that we would have met them.
Yeah.
Big one.
Oh yeah, and is FIRE just for privileged people? We get that a lot, right? Because they look at Mr. Money Mustache and they're like, oh yeah, you have to be in IT, and you know, you have to be like born relatively wealthy, and how can you do this? And which is one of the reasons why I wrote Quit Like a Millionaire, because it's to show that I was not born privileged. When I was born, that when I was a kid, the things that I was struggling with was like drinking water that's not contaminated, that wouldn't give me stomach worms.
Yeah. Right?
Digging around in the trash for toys. And I didn't know what a millionaire was. I didn't know what a portfolio was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what any of those things were. And then, you know, gradually you through the lessons that I learned through being poor and then becoming middle class and becoming rich, we ended up getting here. So FIRE is not for only the privileged, right? It helps, but you don't actually, it's like a set of mathematical rules and breaking down how money works with a set of simple rules that can get you to financial independence. And you absolutely don't need privilege to get here.
Awesome. And so that's really a good spot to start to move into the second half of our conversation, which is focused on what you've learned. So could you walk us through and give us a quick overview of the book and sort of what you've learned throughout this process?
For sure. Okay, so the book actually came about, we didn't actually set out to write a book. An editor from Penguin read our blog and she actually came and asked us if we wanted to write her book. At first, my initial reaction was like, no, I didn't do anything special. Like, why would anyone care about this story?
Yeah.
Why did I write this book? And then she, like, just from talking to her and she kind of, you know, from reading the blog and knowing my background, she said, well, the fact that you went from living on 44 cents a day to becoming a millionaire means that you don't, it doesn't require privilege. And, you know, breaking down the financial concepts in a way that's easy and accessible for people to understand, that would be really useful. And so that's why the book is divided into three parts. So it starts with poverty, and then it goes into middle class, and the final section is about becoming rich. And okay. So these are the lessons that I learned in order to get here. And I do believe that this is absolutely reproducible, because it's lessons that's mathematically reproducible and doesn't require luck or any kind of like long shot, right? Like just starting the next
winning the lottery, whatever.
Yeah, you don't need to start the next Snapchat. Well, actually, it already exists. So if I start it, it's going to fail because it already exists. exactly. So I wanted to tell it from like a storytelling perspective, like following my journey all the way throughout, because we do come from a fiction background. Like that's, we tried to write children's novels on the side while I was a programmer, because I want people to understand this and not be turned off by finance books. Because one of the things that when I started to learn about finance, I was so intimidated from all the finance books. There's these like giant tomes, right? And you're like, like I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through this. And do I have to be really smart in order to figure this out? So I wanted the book to be accessible so that people who don't normally read finance books would read it and be able to understand it, right? Because if you learn this lesson in life, it makes life so much easier. Like we say in the book, if you figure out money, life is incredibly easy. If you don't figure out money, life is incredibly hard. But it's really not that complicated. It's a series of simple lessons that if you learn it, then you will become a millionaire.
Yeah, in reading it, it was fantastic. And it's very easy to walk through the story because it's a true story. It's you walking through what your life was like. And so just a couple last quick questions sort of as we start to wrap up here. What are some of the key takeaways that you've gotten from your career and everything that you've been working on?
I think from, as a woman specifically working in engineering, it was actually quite intimidating, because going into engineering, there was only about 10 girls in a class of 120 people.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a very male-dominated, very male-dominated field.
Yeah.
But I think it's such a useful skill, and it was a skill that really paid off for me. So one of the things that I did after retirement was I mentored girls on how to code, and I volunteer for a nonprofit because I want women to not be afraid of this field. It's a male-dominated field, but once you figure it out, it is actually like very lucrative, and it does teach you a lot of very useful skills. One thing that I found in my career is that as a woman, it's difficult for women to be disagreeable. Like we tend to be more, you know, like accommodating and saying, yeah, sure, I'll take on all this extra work, which
like
is
compromising.
Yeah, compromising and saying like, whenever my boss had extra work, just like, bring it on, I'll just take on the work. Yes, I want to show my work ethic. But there is some point in which you have to know your worth. And if you know your worth, like that's how you get paid for how the actual amount of work that you're doing. And don't sell yourself short. So for me, when I knew that the amount of work that I was doing was at the next level and that I should be paid what I deserve, right? And I asked for it instead of just working hard, putting my head down, and then just expecting a promotion. And that's actually pushing against my culture too, because coming from an Asian culture, we're supposed to not make, you know, not make a fuss, quietly, like get your work done and people will know your worth. Your work should speak for itself. But for me, I was verbal about, you know, I need to get this promotion because look, my work speaks for itself. Like I wrote up the report showing like how much work I had done and the fact that I was already at the next level. And as a result, I got two promotions within 4 years, right? So it's just like, don't be afraid, especially if you're a woman working in a field that's very male dominated, don't be afraid to ask for what you are worth. and don't just work there and work hard and expect people to notice, because you need to stand your ground and make sure that you are being paid what you are worth. That's
one of the... Be willing to ask.
Yeah, don't be afraid to ask and be paid what you're worth. That's one of my biggest takeaways from my career.
Awesome. And what bit of advice would you give your 20-year-old self? The one thing.
I don't know. I mean, like, I guess, like, don't be afraid of, like, of looking for different kind of, like, ways of living, because for the longest time I thought that the one path that everybody kind of went through is like the normal one, and it's the only one available to me. But if you want, like, I think for me, what the biggest realization that I had now is that if you make decisions with a herd, because a lot of people make they kind of go, what do I need to do when it comes to a decision, like what career should I pick, or what should I buy a house and this kind of stuff. They just look to see what everyone else is doing, and with the idea that if you follow along with the herd, it's going to be okay. But if you make decisions like normal people, you're going to get a normal result. Like normal in, normal out, right? Like, but if you want an extraordinary life, you're going to have to make some scary, extraordinary decisions. And that took me a long time to figure out.
Yeah, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think to my 20-year-old self, I would say don't be attracted to just putting your money into a savings account. Because, again, growing up poor, who's going to teach you about investing, right? Like, my parents didn't know anything about investing. They were just like, buy houses or put it into a savings account. But, again, that's something like when you're 20s, you're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be safe. But it's not safe. Like, if you're getting paid, you know, inflation is running 2 to 3%, and you're getting paid like 0.5 to 1.5%. You're losing money every single year. It's worth less and less. So I would say to my 20-year-old self, do not be afraid to invest and get into the market and learn how to invest as quickly as possible, because then because you're young, you have such a long runway, and let compounding do its work. Don't be suckered into putting your money into putting it into safety. Things that seem safe are not really that safe.
Awesome. I love it. Well, Christy Shen and Bryce Leung, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you guys. You're the authors of Quit Like a Millionaire. You also write Millennial Revolution. I will make sure to link to both of those in the show notes as well. Thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that does it for our show with Christy Shen and Bryce Leung from Millennial Revolution. I do want to say that after reading the book Quit Like a Millionaire that the two of them wrote, and then chatting with them, the story was written in a way that's very raw and very genuine to their individual styles. And so it was absolutely fascinating talking with them and understanding some of the pros and cons of what they've walked through. This concept of personal finance is very, very important, especially for those of us who are going a more entrepreneurial role, but mostly for all young professionals and college students that are dealing with college debt. Unless you address that up front and start to put a plan together to pay that down, student debt is something that can really shackle you and restrict your options in what direction you can go once you launch your career. Christy's approach to financial independence and retiring early really is interesting to me. She leveraged a consistent, stable job. She calculated this POT, POT score, for how well a college degree would return within a given field. And she used that score to find a career path that would be relatively stable, because she knew she would be on her own to support her own financial needs. At the same time, she used that to hedge her risk in learning to be an author. So she really had this stable income that allowed her to learn and grow in the author route, which is ultimately the direction she wanted to take her career. So you don't have to go all or nothing. If you're willing to put in the extra effort and the extra work to learn your side hustle and pursue your passion while also holding down a major job, there's a ton of upside, because then you get all the stability of a consistent 9-to-5 while building a safe retirement income and building and paying down your debt, while also getting to do the thing you love and sharpening your skills, so that once you hit that early retirement number, you can really take a dive and go headfirst into what you've loved and what you have sharpened over the last few years. Really hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Like I said, personal finance is something that's near and dear to my heart, and so I hope you got a lot of actionable takeaways from this show, and I would definitely recommend reading the book Quit Like a Millionaire. It is fantastic. They did a great job writing it. From Taste for Tenacity, show Number 21, this is Ben Trella. Thanks for listening.